soothe. But it hits you again, harder this time than that moment topside when you started to come apart in front of Vika. It's over. This whole strange journey, keeping it together, keeping focused on your goal, it's all been pointless. Nasun's gone. You've lost her. And Jija will never pay for what he's done. And you? What the rust do you matter? Who cares about you? Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Once, you did have people who cared about you. Once, there were children who looked up to you and lived on your every word. Once, twice, three times, but the first two don't count. There was a man you woke up next to every morning, who gave a damn that you existed. Once you lived surrounded by the walls he built for you, in a home you made together, in a community that actually chose to take you in. All of it built on lies. Matter of time, really, till it fell apart. Listen, Lerna says. His voice makes you blink, and that makes tears fall. More tears. You've been sitting there in silence, crying for a while now. He shifts over to your bench and you lean on him. You know you shouldn't, but you do, and when he puts an arm around you, you take comfort in it. He is a friend, at least. He will always be that. Maybe. Maybe this isn't a bad thing, being here. You can't think with everything going on. This calm is strange. He grimaces. I'm not sure I like being here, but it's better than being topside right now. Maybe with some time to think, you'll figure out where Jija might have gone. He's trying so hard. You shake your head a little, but you're too empty to really muster an objection. Do you have a place? They gave me this. They must have given you something. There's plenty of room here. You nod. And Lerna takes a deep breath. Then let's go there. You can introduce me to these companions of yours. So, you pull it together. Then you lead him out of his place and in a direction that feels like it might bring you to the apartment you were assigned. Along the way, you have more time to appreciate just how unbearably strange this calm is. There's one chamber you pass, embedded in one of the whiter, brighter crystals that holds racks and racks of flat trays like cookie sheets. There's another chamber, dusty and unused, that holds what you assume are torture devices, except they're incompetently made. You're not sure how a pair of rings suspended from the ceiling on chains are supposed to hurt. And then there are the metal stairs. The ones built by whoever created this place. There are other stairs, more recently made. But it's easy to tell them from the originals. Because the original stairs don't rust, haven't deteriorated at all, and are not purely utilitarian. There are strange decorations along the railings and edges of the walkways. Embossed faces, wrought vines in the shape of no plants you've ever seen. Something that you think is writing, except it consists solely of pointy shapes in various sizes. It actually pulls you out of your mood to try to figure out what you're seeing. This is madness, you say, running your fingers over a decoration that looks like a snarling Kirkuza. This place is one big dead civ ruin, just like 100,000 others all over the stillness. Ruins are death traps. The equatorial calms flatten or sink theirs if they can, and that's the smartest thing anyone's ever done. If the people who made this place couldn't survive it, why should any of us try? Not all ruins are death traps. Lerna's edging along the platform while keeping very close to the crystal shaft it wends around, and keeping his eyes fixed straight ahead. Sweat beads his upper lip. You hadn't realized he's afraid of heights, but then Tarimo is as flat as it is boring. His voice is carefully calm. There are rumors Eumenes is built on a whole series of Dead Civ ruins. And look how well that turned out, you don't say. These people should have just built a wall like everyone else, you do say. But then you stop, because it occurs to you that the goal is survival. And sometimes survival requires change. Just because the usual strategies have worked, building a wall, taking in the useful and excluding the useless, arming and storing and hoping for luck, doesn't mean that other methods might not. This, though? Climbing down a hole and hiding in a ball of sharp rocks with a bunch of stone-eaters and ragas? Seems especially unwise. If they try to keep me here, they'll find that out, you murmur. If Lerna hears you, he does not respond. Eventually, you find your apartment. Tonki is awake and in the living room, eating a big bowl of something that didn't come from your packs. It looks like some kind of porridge, and it's got little yellowish things in it that make you recoil at first, until she tilts the bowl and you realize it's sprouted grains, standard store cash food. She looks at you warily as you come in, but her revelations were so minor compared to everything else you've had to face today, that you just wave a greeting and settle down opposite her as usual. She relaxes. Lerna's polite but guarded with Tonki, and she's the same with him, until he mentions that he's been running blood and urine tests on the people of Kostrima to watch for vitamin deficiencies. You almost smile when she leans forward and says, "With what kind of equipment?" with a familiar, greedy look on her face. Then Hoa comes in the apartment. You're surprised, since you hadn't realized he'd gone out. His ice-white gaze flicks immediately to Lerna and examines him ruthlessly. Then he relaxes, so visibly that you only now realize Hoa's been tense all this time, since you came into this crazy calm. But you file this away as just another oddity to explore later, because Hoa says, "Asen, there's someone here you should meet." "Who?" "A man? From Eumenes." All three of you stare at him. "Why," you say slowly in case you've misunderstood something, "would I want to meet someone from Eumenes?" "He asked for you." You decide to try for patience. "Hoa, I don't know anyone from Eumenes. Not anymore, anyway." "He says he knows you. He tracked you here, got here ahead of you when he realized it was where you were headed." Hoa scowls just a little, as if this bothers him. "He says he wants to see you, see if you can do it yet."
"Do what?"
"He just said it." Hoa's eyes slide first to Tonki, then to Lerna, before returning to you. Something he doesn't want them to hear, maybe. "He's like you." "What?" "Okay." You rub your eyes, take a deep breath, and say it so he'll know there's no need to hide it. "Araga, then." "Yes." "No." "Like you." "His?" Hoa waggles his fingers in lieu of words. Tonki opens her mouth. You gesture sharply at her. She glares back. After a moment, Hoa sighs. "He said, if you wouldn't come, to tell you that you owe him. For Corundum." You freeze.
"Alabaster," you whisper.
"Yes," says Hoa, brightening. "That's his name." And then he frowns more, thoughtfully this time. "He's dying." Madness season. 3 before Imperial to 7 Imperial. The eruption of the Kiash traps, multiple vents of an ancient supervolcano, the same one responsible for the twin season, believed to have occurred approximately 10,000 years previous, launched large deposits of olivine and other dark-colored pyroclasts into the air. The resulting 10 years of darkness were not only devastating in the usual seasonal way, but resulted in a much higher than usual incidence of mental illness. The Sanzed warlord Verisha conquered multiple ailing Khoms through the use of psychological warfare designed to convince her foes that gates and walls offered no reliable protection, and that phantasms lurked nearby. She was named Emperor on the day the first sunlight reappeared. From The Seasons of Sansa. 22. Cyanite, Fractured. It's the morning after a raucous party that the Maovites threw to celebrate the Klausu's safe return and acquisition of some especially prized goods. High-quality stone for decorative carving, aromatic woods for furniture building, fancy brocade cloth that's worth twice its weight in diamonds, and a goodly amount of tradable currency, including high-denomination paper and whole fingers of mother-of-pearl. No food, but with that kind of money they can send traders to buy canoes full of anything they need on the mainland. Harless broke out a cask of fearsomely strong Antarctic mead to celebrate, and half the Khoms still sleeping it off. It's 5 days after Cyanite shut down a volcano that she started, which killed a whole city, and 8 days after she killed 2 ships full of people to keep her family's existence secret. It feels like everyone is celebrating the multiple mass murders she's committed. She's still in bed, having retired to it as soon as the ship was unloaded. Inan hasn't come to the house yet. She told him to go and tell the stories of the trip, because the people expect it of him, and she does not want him suffering for her melancholy. He's got Koru with him, because Koru loves celebrations. Everyone feeds him, everyone cuddles him. He even tries to help Inan tell the stories, yelling nonsense at the top of his lungs. The child is more like Inan than he has any physical right to be. Alabaster is the one who stayed with Cyan, talking to her through her silence, forcing her to respond when she would rather just stop thinking. He says he knows what it's like to feel like this, though he won't tell her how or what happened. She believes him, regardless. "You should go," she says at last. "Join the storytelling. Remind Koru he's got at least 2 parents who are worth something."
"Don't be stupid. He's got 3.
Inan thinks I'm a terrible mother." Alabaster sighed.
"No, you're just not the kind of mother Inan wants you to be. You're the kind of mother our son needs, though."
She turns her head to frown at him. He shrugs.
"Corundum will be strong someday. He needs strong parents.
He falters abruptly. You practically feel him decide to change the subject.
"Here, I brought you something."
Cyan sighs and pushes herself up as he crouches beside the bed, unfolding a little cloth parcel. In it, when she gets curious despite herself and leans closer, are 2 polished stone rings, just right for her fingers. One's made of jade, the other mother of pearl. She glares at him, and he shrugs.
"Shutting down an active volcano isn't something a mere 4-ringer could do."
"We're free," she says it doggedly, even though she doesn't feel free. She fixed Alia, after all, completing the mission the Fulcrum sent her there for, however belatedly and perversely. It's the sort of thing that makes her laugh uncontrollably when she thinks about it, so she pushes on before she can. "We don't need to wear any rings anymore, or black uniforms. I haven't put my hair in a bun in months. You don't have to service every woman they send you, like some kind of stud animal. Let the Fulcrum go."
Baster smiles a little, sadly. We can't, Cyan. One of us is going to have to train Kuru.
We don't have to train him to do anything.
Cyan lies down again. She wishes he would go away.
Let him learn the basics from Inan and Harless. That's been enough to let these people get by for centuries.
Inan couldn't have stilled that blow, Cyan. If he'd tried, he might have blown the hot spot underneath it wide and set off a season. You saved the world from that.
Then give me a medal, not rings. She's glaring at the ceiling. Except I'm the reason that blow even existed, so maybe not.
Alabaster reaches up to stroke her hair away from her face. He does that a lot now that she wears it loose. She's always been a little ashamed of her hair. It's curly, but with no stiffness to it at all. Whether the straight stiffness of sunset hair or the kinky stiffness of coaster hair. She's such a mid-letter mutt that she doesn't even know which of her ancestors to blame for the hair. At least it doesn't get in her way.
We are what we are, he says, with such gentleness that she wants to cry.
We are Misalem, not Shimshana. You've heard that story?
Cyanite's fingers twitch in remembered pain.
Yes. From your guardian, right? They like to tell that one to kids.
Baster shifts to lean against the bedpost with his back to her, relaxing. Cyanite thinks about telling him to leave, but never says it aloud.
She's not looking at him, so she has no idea what he does with the bundle of rings that she didn't take. He can eat them for all she cares. My guardian gave me that nonsense too, Cyan. The monstrous Misalem, who decided to declare war against a whole nation, and off the Sunset Emperor for no particular reason. In spite of herself, Cyanite frowns.
He had a reason?
A weevil earth, of course. Use your rusting head.
It's annoying to be scolded, and annoyance pushes back her apathy a little more.
Good old Alabaster, cheering her up by pissing her off.
She turns her head to glare at the back of his.
Well, what was the reason?
The simplest and most powerful reason of all. Revenge. That emperor was an Anaphumeth, and the whole thing happened just after the end of the season of teeth. That's the season they don't talk about much in any creche.
There was mass starvation in the Northern Hemisphere comms. They got hit harder since the shake that started the whole thing was near the Northern Pole. The season took a year longer to take hold in the equatorials and the south.
How do you know all this?
It's nothing science ever heard, in the grit crucibles or elsewhere.
Alabaster shrugs, shaking the whole bed.
I wasn't allowed to train with the other grits in my year group. I had rings before most of them had pubic hair. The instructors let me loose in the seniors' library to make up for it. They didn't pay a lot of attention to what I read.
He sighs.
Also, on my first mission, there was an archaeomest who... We talked, in addition to other things.
She doesn't know why Alabaster bothers being shy about his affairs. She's watched Inan fuck him into incoherence on more than one occasion. Then again, maybe it's not the sex that he's shy about.
Anyway, it's all there if you put the facts together and think beyond what we're taught. Sansa was a new empire then, still growing at the height of its power. But it was mostly in the northern half of the equatorials at the time. Eumenes wasn't actually the capital then. And some of the bigger Sunset comms weren't as good at preparing for seasons as they are now. They lost their food store caches somehow. Fire, fungus, earth knows what. To survive, all the Sunset comms decided to work together, attacking the comms of any lesser races.
His lip curls.
That's when they started calling us lesser races, actually.
So they took those other comms store caches.
Cyan can guess that much.
She's getting bored.
No. No one had any stores left by the end of that season.
The Sunzeds took people.
People? For what?
Then she understands. There's no need for slaves during a season. Every calm has its strong backs, and if they need more, there are always calmless people desperate enough to work in exchange for food. Human flesh becomes valuable for other reasons, though, when things get bad enough. So, says Alabaster, oblivious when Cyan lies there fighting nausea, that season is when the Sunzeds developed a taste for certain rarefied delicacies. And even after the season ended and green things grew and the livestock turned herbivorous or stopped hibernating, they kept at it. They would send out parties to raid smaller settlements and new comms held by races without Sunzed allies. All the accounts differ on the details, but they agree on one thing. Misalem was the only survivor when his family was taken in a raid. Supposedly his children were slaughtered for Anathomath's own table, though I suspect that's a bit of dramatic embellishment. Alabaster sighs. Regardless, they died, and it was Anathomath's fault, and he wanted Anathomath dead for it, like any man would. But Araga is not any man. Ragas have no right to get angry, to want justice, to protect what they love. For his presumption, Shemshenna had killed him, and became a hero for doing it. Cyanite considers this in silence. Then Alabaster shifts a little, and she feels his hand press the bundle, the one with the rings in it, into her unresisting palm. Origins built the fulcrum, he says. She's almost never heard him say origin. We did it under threat of genocide, and we used it to buckle a collar around our own necks, but we did it. We are the reason old Sansa grew so powerful and lasted so long, and why it still half rules the world, even if no one will admit it. We are the ones who figured out just how amazing our kind can be, if we learn how to refine the gift we're born with. It's a curse, not a gift. Cyanite closes her eyes, but she doesn't push away the bundle. It's a gift if it makes us better. It's a curse if we let it destroy us. You decide that, not the instructors or the guardians or anyone else. There's another shift, and the bed moves a little as Alabaster leans on it. A moment later, she feels his lips on her brow, dry and approving. Then he settles back down on the floor beside the bed and says nothing more. I thought I saw a guardian, she says after a while, very softly, at Alia. Alabaster doesn't reply for a moment. She's decided that he won't when he says, I will tear the whole world apart if they ever hurt us again. But we would still be hurt, she thinks. It's reassuring, though, somehow. The kind of lie she needs to hear. Cyanite keeps her eyes closed and doesn't move for a long while. She's not sleeping. She's thinking. Alabaster stays while she does it, and for that she is unutterably glad. When the world ends, 3 weeks later, it happens on the most beautiful day Cyanite has ever seen. The sky is clear for miles, save for the occasional drift of cloud. The sea is calm, and even the omnipresent wind is warm and humid for once, instead of cool and scouring. It's so beautiful that the entire calm decides to head up to the heights. The able-bodied carry the ones who can't make the steps, while the children go underfoot and nearly kill everyone. The people on cook duty put fish cakes and pieces of cut fruit and balls of seasoned grain into little pots that can be carried easily, and everyone brings blankets. Inan has a musical instrument Cyanite has never seen before, something like a drum with guitar strings, which would probably be all the rage in Eumenes if it ever caught on there. Alabaster has corundum. Cyanite brings a truly awful novel someone found on the looted freighter, the sort of thing whose first page made her wince and burst into giggles. Then, of course, she kept reading. She loves books that are just for fun.
The Maovites spread themselves over the slope behind a ridge that blocks most of the wind, but where the sun is full and bright. Sinite puts her blanket a ways from everyone else, but they quickly encroach on her, spreading out their blankets right alongside and grinning at her when she glares. She has come to realize over the past 3 years that most Maovites regard her and Alabaster as something like wild animals that have decided to scavenge off human habitations. Impossible to civilize, kind of cute, and at least an amusing nuisance. So when they see that she obviously needs help with something and won't admit it, they help her anyway. And they constantly pet Alabaster and hug him and grab his hands and swing him into dancing, which Cyan is at least grateful no one tries with her. Then again, everyone can see that Alabaster likes being touched, no matter how much he pretends standoffishness. It probably isn't something he got a lot of in the fulcrum, where everyone was afraid of his power. Perhaps likewise they think Cyan enjoys being reminded that she is part of a group now, contributing, and contributed to, and that she no longer needs to guard herself against everyone and everything. They're right. That doesn't mean she's going to tell them so. Then it's all Inan tossing Koru up in the air, while Alabaster tries to pretend he's not terrified, even as his orogeny sends micro-shakes through the island's underwater strata with every toss. And Hemu, starting some kind of chanted poetry game set to music that all the Maovites seem to know. And Uff's toddler, Owl, trying to run across the spread-out blankets and stepping on at least 10 people before someone grabs her and tickles her down. And a basket being passed around that contains little clay bottles of something that burns Cyan's nose when she sniffs it. And she could love these people, she thinks sometimes. Perhaps she does already, she isn't sure. But after Inan flops down for a nap with Koru already asleep on his chest, and after the poetry chant has turned into a vulgar joke contest, and once she's drunk enough of the bottle stuff that the world is actually beginning to move on its own, Cyanite lifts her eyes and catches Alabaster's. He's propped himself on one elbow to browse the terrible book she's finally abandoned. He's making horrible and hilarious faces as he skims it. Meanwhile, his free hand toys with one of Inan's braids, and he looks nothing at all like the half-mad monster Feldspar sent her off with at the beginning of this journey. His eyes flick up to meet hers, and for just a moment there is wariness there. Cyan blinks in surprise at this, but then she is the only person here who knows what his life was like before. Does he resent her for being here? A constant reminder of what he'd rather forget. He smiles, and she frowns in automatic reaction. His smile widens more. You still don't like me, do you? Cyanite snorts. What do you care? He shakes his head, amused, and then he reaches out and strokes a hand over Koru's hair. The child stirs and murmurs in his sleep, and Alabaster's face softens. Would you like to have another child? Cyanite starts, her mouth falling open. Of course not. I didn't want this one. But he's here now. And he's beautiful, isn't he? You make such beautiful children. Which is probably the most inane thing he could ever say. But then, he's Alabaster. You could have the next one with Inan. Maybe Inan should have a say in that before we settle his breeding future. He loves Koru and he's a good father. He's got 2 other kids already and they're fine. Stills, though. He considers. You and Inan might have a child who's still. That wouldn't be a terrible thing here. Cyanite shakes her head, but she's thinking about the little pessary the island women have shown her how to use, thinking maybe she will stop using it. But she says, freedom means we get to control what we do now. No one else. Yes, but now that I can think about what I want. He shrugs as if nonchalant. But there's an intensity in his gaze as he looks at Inan and Koru.
I've never wanted much from life. Just to be able to live it, really. I'm not like you, Sion. I don't need to prove myself. I don't want to change the world, or help people, or be anything great. I just want this.
She gets that. So she lies down on her side of Inan, and Alabaster lies down on his side, and they relax and enjoy the sensation of wholeness, of contentment for a while. Because they can.
Of course it cannot last.
Cyanite wakes when Inan sits up and shadows her. She hadn't intended to nap, but she's had a good long one, and now the sun is slanting toward the ocean. Koru's fussing, and she sits up automatically, rubbing her face with one hand and reaching with the other to see if his cloth diaper is full. It's fine, but the sounds he's making are anxious, and when she comes more awake, she sees why. Inan is sitting up with Koru held absently in one arm, but he is frowning as he looks at Alabaster. Alabaster's on his feet, his whole body tense.
Something, he murmurs.
He's facing the direction of the mainland, but he can't possibly see anything. The ridge is in the way. Then again, he's not using his eyes. So Sion frowns and sends forth her own awareness, worrying that there's a tsunami or worse on its way. But there's nothing.
A conspicuous nothingness. There should be something.
There's a plate boundary between the island that is Mayov and the mainland. Plate boundaries are never still. They jump and twitch and vibrate against one another in a million infinitesimal ways that only Avraga can sense. Like the electricity that engineers can make come out of water turbines and vats of chemicals. But suddenly, impossibly, the plate edge cesses are still.
Confused,
Cyanite starts to look at Alabaster, but her attention is caught by Corundum, who's bouncing and struggling in Inan's hands, whining and snotting and having a full-on tantrum, though he's usually not the kind of baby who does that sort of thing. Alabaster's looking at the baby, too. His expression changes to something twisted and terrible.
No, he says. He's shaking his head. No. No, I won't let them. Not again.
What? Cyanite's staring at him, trying not to notice the dread that's rising in her. Feeling, rather than seeing, as others rise around them, murmuring and reacting to their alarm. A couple of people trot up the ridge to see what they can.
Bastar, what? For Earth's sake!
He makes a sound that is not a word, just negation. And suddenly he takes off, running up the slope toward the ridge. Cyanite stares after him, then at Inan, who looks even more confused than she is. Inan shakes his head. But the people who preceded Bastar up the ridge are shouting now, and signaling everyone else. Something is wrong. Cyanite and Inan hurry up the slope along with others. They all reach the top together, and there they stand looking at the span of ocean on the mainlandward side of the island, where there are four ships, tiny, but visibly coming closer on the horizon. Inan says a bad word and shoves Koru at Cyanite, who almost fumbles him but then holds him close, while Inan rummages amid his pockets and packs, and comes up with his smaller spyglass. He extends it, and looks hard for a moment, then frowns, while Cyanite tries ineffectually to console Koru. Koru's inconsolable. When Inan lowers it, Cyanite grabs his arm and pushes Koru at him, taking the device from his hand when he does. The four ships are bigger now. Their sails are white, ordinary. She can't figure out what's got Alabaster so upset. And then she notices the figures, standing at one boat's prow, wearing burgundy. The shock of it steals the breath from her chest. She steps back, mouths the word that Inan needs to hear, but it comes out strengthless, inaudible. Inan takes the spyglass from her because she looks like she's about to drop it. than because they have to do something. She's got to do something. She concentrates and focuses and says louder, Guardians!
Inan frowns.
Ho!
She watches as he too realizes what this means. He looks away for a moment, wondering. And then he shakes his head.
How they found Mayov does not matter. They cannot be allowed to land. They cannot be allowed to live.
Give Koru to someone,
he says, backing away from the ridge. His expression has hardened.
We are going to need you, Sion.
Sionite nods and turns, looking around. De'Elashet, one of a handful of Sanzids in the calm, is hurrying past with her own little one, who's maybe 6 months older than Koru. She's kept Koru on occasion, nursing him when Sionite was busy. Sionite flags her down and runs to her.
Please,
she says, pushing Koru into her arms. De'Elashet nods. Koru, however, does not agree with the plan. He clings to Sionite, screaming and kicking him. Evil Earth, the whole island rocks all of a sudden.
De'Elashet staggers, and then stares at Sionite in horror.
Shit, she murmurs, and takes Koru back. Then, with him on her hip, he calms immediately. She runs to catch up with Inan, who is already running toward the metal stairs, shouting to his crew to board the Klaasu and ready it for launch. It's madness. It's all madness, she thinks as she runs. It doesn't make sense that the Guardians have discovered this place. It doesn't make sense that they're coming. Why here? Why now? Mayov has been around, pirating the coast for generations. The only thing that's different is Sionite and Alabaster. She ignores the little voice in the back of her mind that whispers, they followed you somehow, you know they did. You should never have gone back to Alia. It was a trap. You should never have come here. Everything you touch is death. She does not look down at her hands where, just to let Alabaster know she appreciated the gesture, she's put on the four rings that the fulcrum gave her, plus his two. The last two aren't real, after all. She hasn't passed any sort of ring test for them. But who would know whether she merits these rings better than a man who's earned 10? And for shit's sake, she's still the rusting volcano made by a broken obelisk with a stone eater inside. So Sionite decides, suddenly and fiercely, that she's going to show these rusting guardians just what a six-ringer can do. She reaches the calm level, where it's chaos. People pulling out glass knives and rolling out catapults and balls of chain from wherever the rust they've been keeping them, gathering belongings, loading boats with fishing spears. Then Sion's running up the plank onto the Klaasu, where Inan is shouting for the anchor to be pulled up, and all at once it occurs to her to wonder where Alabaster has gone. She stumbles to a halt on the ship's deck, and as she does, she feels a flare of orogeny so deep and powerful that for a moment, she thinks the whole world shakes. All the water in the harbor dances with tiny pointillations for a moment. Sion suspects the clouds felt that one. And suddenly, there is a wall rising from the sea not 500 yards off the harbor. It is a massive block of solid stone, as perfectly rectangular as if it were chiseled. Huge enough to... Oh, flaking rust, no. Seal off the damned harbor.
Faster! Earth, damn it!
It's impossible to be heard over the roar of water and the grind of the stone. As big as the island of Mayov itself, Alabaster is raising. How can he do this with no shake or hot spot nearby? Half the island should be iced. But then something flickers at the corner of Sionite's vision, and she turns to see the amethyst obelisk off in the distance. It's closer than before. It's coming to meet them. That's how. Inan is cursing, furious. He understands full well that Alabaster is being an overprotective fool, however he's doing it. His fury becomes effort. Fog rises from the water around the ship, and the deck planks nearby creak and frost over as he tries to smash apart the nearest part of the wall so that they can get out there and fight, The wall splinters, and then there is a low boom behind it. When the part of the wall that Inan has shattered crumbles away, there's just another block of stone behind it. Sinite's got her hands full trying to modulate the waves in the water. It is possible to use orogeny on water, just difficult. She's getting the hang of it at last. After this long, living near such a great expanse of water, it's one of the few things Inan's been able to teach her and Alabaster. There's enough warmth and mineral content in the sea that she can feel it. And water moves enough like stone, just faster, that she can manipulate it a little, delicately. Still, she does this now, holding Koru close so he's within the safe zone of her torus, and concentrating hard to send shock waves against the coming waves at just enough velocity to break them. It mostly works. The Klaasu rocks wildly and tears loose from its moorings, and one of the piers collapse, but nothing capsizes, and no one dies. Sinite counts this as a win.
What the rust is he doing?
Inan says, panting, and she follows his gaze to see Alabaster at last. He stands on the highest point of the island, up on the slopes. Even from here, Sion can see the blistering cold of his torus. The warmer air around it wavers as the temperature changes, and all the moisture in the wind blowing past him precipitates out as snow. If he's using the obelisk, then he shouldn't need the ambient, should he? Unless he's doing so much that even the obelisk can't fuel it. Earth fires, Sion says. I have to go up there. Inan grabs her arm. When she looks up at him, his eyes are wide and a little afraid.
We'd only be a liability to him.
We can't just sit here and wait. He's not reliable. Even as she says this, her belly clenches. Inan has never seen Alabaster lose it. She doesn't want Inan to see that. Alabaster's been so good here at Maeve. He's almost not crazy anymore. But Sion thinks, what broke once will break again more easily. And she shakes her head and tries to hand him Koru.
I have to. Maybe I can help. Koru won't let me give him to anyone else. Please.
Inan curses, but takes the child, who clutches at Inan's shirt, and puts his thumb in his mouth. Then Sion is off, running along the calm edge and up the steps. As she gets over the rock barrier, she can finally see what's happening beyond it, and for a moment she stumbles to a halt in shock. The ships are much closer, right beyond the wall that Bastyr has raised to protect the harbor. There are only three of them, though, because one ship has floundered off course and is listing badly. No, it's sinking. She has no idea how he managed that. Another is riding strangely in the water, mast broken and bow raised and keel visible. And that's when Sinite realizes there are boulders piled on its rear deck. Alabaster's been dropping rocks on the bastards. She has no idea how, but the sight of it makes her want to cheer. But the other two ships have split up, one coming straight for the island, the other peeling off, perhaps to circle around or maybe get out of Alabaster's rock-dropping range. No, you don't, Sion thinks, and she tries to do what she did to the attack ship during their last raid, dragging a splinter of bedrock up from the sea floor to spear the thing. She frosts a 10-foot space around her to do it, and makes chunks of ice spread over the water between her and the ship. But she gets the splinter shaped and loose, and starts to pull it up, and it stops. And the gathering strength of her orogeny just dissipates. She gasps as the heat and force spill away. And then she understands. This ship has a guardian on it, too. Maybe they all do, which explains why Bastyr hasn't destroyed them already. He can't attack a guardian directly. All he can do is hurl boulders from outside the guardian's negation radius. She can't even imagine how much power that must take. He could never have managed it without the obelisk, and if he weren't the crazy, ornery ten-ringer that he is. Well, just because she can't hit the thing directly doesn't mean she can't find some other way to do it. She runs along the ridge as the ship she tried to destroy passes behind the island, keeping it in sight. Do they think there's another way up? If so, they'll be sorely disappointed. Mayov's harbor is the only part of the island that's remotely approachable. The rest of the island is a single jagged sheer column, which gives her an idea. Cyanite grins and stops, then drops to her hands and knees so she can concentrate. She doesn't have Alabaster strength. She doesn't even know how to reach the amethyst without his guidance, and after what happened at Alia, she's afraid to try. The plate boundary is too far for her to reach, and there are no nearby vents or hot spots. But she has Mayov itself. All that lovely, heavy, flaky schist. So she throws herself down. Deep. Deeper. She feels her way along the ridges and the layers of the rock that is Mayov, seeking the best point of fracture. The fulcrum, she laughs to herself. At last she finds it. Good. And there, coming around the island's curve, is the ship. Yes. Cyanite drags all the heat and infinitesimal life out of the rock in one concentrated spot. The moisture is still there, though, and that's what freezes and expands as cyanite forces it colder and colder, taking more and more from it, spinning her torus fine and oblong, so that it slices along the grain of the rock like a knife through meat. A ring of frost forms around her, but it's nothing compared to the long searing plank of ice that's growing down the inside of the rock, levering it apart. And then, right when the ship approaches the point, she unleashes all the strength the island has given her, shoving it right back where it came from. A massive, narrow finger of stone splits away from the cliff face. Inertia holds it where it is just for a moment. And then with a low, hollow groan, it peels away from the island, splintering at its base near the waterline. Cyanite opens her eyes and gets up and runs, slipping once on her own ice ring to that end of the island. She's tired, and after a few steps she has to slow to a walk, gasping for breath around a stitch in her side. But she gets there in time to see. The finger of rock has landed squarely on the ship. She grins fiercely at the sight of the deck splintered apart as she hears screams, as she sees people already in the water. Most wear a variety of clothing, hirelings then. But she thinks she sees one flash of burgundy cloth under the water's surface, being dragged deeper by one of the sinking ship halves. Guard that, you cannibal sun ruster. Grinning, Cyanite gets up and heads in Alabaster's direction again. As she comes down from the heights, she can see him, a tiny figure, still making his own cold front. And for a moment, she actually admires him. He's amazing, in spite of everything. But then all of a sudden, there's a strange hollow boom from the sea, and something explodes around Alabaster in a spray of rocks and smoke and concussive force. A cannon? A rusting cannon? Inan's told her about these. They're an invention that the Equatorial Comms have been experimenting with in the past few years. Of course Guardians would have one. Cyan breaks into a run, raggedly and clumsily, fueled by fear. She can't see Baster well enough through the smoke of the cannon blast, but she can see that he's down. By the time she gets there, she knows he's hurt. The icy wind has stopped blowing. She can see Alabaster on his hands and knees, surrounded by a circle of blistered ice that is yards wide. Cyanite stops at the outermost ring of ice. If he's out of it, he might not notice that she's within his range of power. Alabaster! He moves a little, and she can hear him groaning, murmuring. Oh, how bad is he hurt? Cyanite dances at the edge of the ice for a moment, then finally decides to risk it, trotting to the clear zone immediately around him. He's still upright, though barely, his head's hanging,
and her belly clenches when she sees flecks of blood on the stone beneath him.
I took out the other ship, she says as she reaches him, hoping to reassure. I can get this one too if you haven't.
It's bravado. She's not sure how much she's got left in her. Hopefully he's taken care of it. But she looks up and curses inwardly because the remaining ship is still out there, apparently undamaged. It seems to be sitting at anchor, waiting. For what, she can't guess.
Cyan, he says. His voice is strained. With fear or something else.
Promise me. You won't let them take Koru. No matter what.
What? Of course I won't.
She steps closer and crouches beside him.
Faster.
He looks up at her dazed, perhaps from the cannon blast. Something's cut his forehead, and like all head wounds, it's bleeding copiously. She checks him over, touching his chest, hoping he's not more hurt. He's still alive, so the cannon blast must have been a near miss. But all it takes is a bit of rock shrapnel at the right speed in the wrong place. And that's when she finally notices. His arms, at the wrists, his knees, and the rest of his legs between thighs and ankles, they're gone. They haven't been cut off or blown off. Each limb ends smoothly, perfectly. Right where the ground begins. And he's moving them about as if it's water and not solid stone that he's trapped in. Struggling, she realizes belatedly. He's not on his hands and knees because he can't stand. He's being dragged into the ground, against his will. The stone eater of rusting earth. Sinat grabs his shoulders and tries to haul him back, but it's like trying to haul a rock. He's heavier somehow. His flesh doesn't feel quite like flesh. The stone eater has made his body pass through solid stone by making him more stone-like somehow. And Sinai can't get him out. He sinks deeper into the stone with each breath. He's up to his shoulders and hips now, and she can't see his feet at all.
Let him go, Earth take you!
The irony of the curse will occur to her only later. What does occur to her in the moment is to stab her awareness into the stone. She tries to feel for the stone eater. There is something there, but it's not like anything she's ever felt before. A heaviness, a weight, too deep and solid and huge to be possible. Not in such a small place, not so compact. It feels like there's a mountain there, dragging Alabaster down with all its weight. He's fighting it. That's the only reason he's still here at all. But he's weak, and he's losing the fight, and she hasn't the first clue of how to help him. The Stone Eater is just too... something. Too much, too big, too powerful, and she cannot help flinching back into herself with a sense that she's just had a near miss.
Promise.
He pants, while she hauls again on his shoulders and tries pushing against the stone with all her power, pulling back against that terrible weight. Anything, everything.
You know what they'll do to him, Cyan. A child that's strong. My child, raised outside the fulcrum. You know.
A wireframe chair in a darkened node station. She can't think about that. Nothing's working, and he's mostly gone into the stone now. Only his face and shoulders are above it, and that's only because he's straining to keep those above the stone line. She babbles at him, sobbing, desperate for words that can somehow fix this.
I know. I promise. Oh, Rust. Faster, please, I can't. Not alone, I can't.
The stone eater's hand rises from the stone, white and solid and rust-tipped. Surprised, Sinai screams and flinches, thinking the creature is attacking her, but no. This hand wraps around the back of Alabaster's head with remarkable gentleness. No one expects mountains to be gentle, but they are inexorable, and when the hand pulls, Alabaster goes. His shoulders slip out of Cyan's hands, his chin, then his mouth, then his nose, then his terrified eyes. He's gone,
Sinai kneels on the hard, cold stone, alone. She is screaming. She is weeping. Her tears fall onto the stone where Alabaster's head was a moment before, and the rock does not soak the tears up. They just splatter. And then she feels it. The drop. The drag.
Startled out of grief, she scrabbles to her feet and stumbles over to the edge of the cliff, where she can see the remaining ship. Ships! The one Bastards hit with rock seems to have righted itself somehow.
No, not somehow. Ice spreads across the water's surface around both ships. There is a Raga on one of the ships, working for the Guardians. A four-ringer, at least. There's too much fine control in what she's feeling. And with that much ice, she sees a group of porpoises leap out of the water, racing away from the spreading ice. And then she sees it catch them, crawling over their bodies and solidifying them, half in and half out of the water. What the hell is this Raga doing with that much power? Then she sees a portion of the rock wall that Vaster raised shiver.
No.
Sinai turns and runs again, breathless, sensing rather than seeing as the Guardian's Raga attacks the wall's base. It's weak where the wall curves to meet the natural curve of Mayov's harbor. The Raga's going to bring it down. It takes an eternity to reach the calm level. And then the docks. She's terrified Inan will set sail without her. He has to be able to assess what's happening, too. But thanks Stone, the Klaasu is still there. And when she staggers up onto its deck, several members of the crew grab her and guide her to sit down before she collapses. They draw up the plank behind her, and she can see that they're striking sails.
Inan!
She gasps as she catches her breath.
Please!
They half carry her to him. He's on the upper deck, one hand on the pilot's wheel and the other holding Koru against his hip. He doesn't look at her, all his attention focused on the wall. There's already a hole in it near the top, and as Cyanite reaches him, there is a final surge. The wall breaks apart and falls into chunks, rocking the ship something fierce, but Inan's completely steady.
We're sailing out to face them,
he says grimly, as she sags onto the bench nearby, and as the ship pulls away from the dock. Everyone's ready for a fight. The catapults are loaded, the javelins in hand.
We'll lead them away from the calm first. That way, everyone else can evacuate in the fishing boats.
There aren't enough fishing boats for everyone, Sinai wants to say and doesn't. Inan knows it anyway. Then the ship is sailing through the narrow gap that the Guardian's origin has made, and the Guardian ship is on them, almost at once. There's a puff of smoke on their deck, and a hollow whoosh right as the Klaasu emerges. The cannon again. A near miss. Inan shouts, and one of the catapult crews returns the favor with a basket of heavy chain, which shreds their foresail and midmast. Another volley. And this time it's a barrel of burning pitch. Sign sees people on fire running across the deck of the Guardian ship after that one hits. The Klaasu whips past, while the Guardian ship founders toward the wall that is Mayov Rock, its deck now a blazing conflagration. But before they can get far, there is another puff of smoke, another boom, and this time the Klaasu judders with the hit. Rust and underfires. How many of those things do they have? Sinai gets up and runs to the railing, trying to see this cannon, though she doesn't know what she can do about it. There's a hole in the Klaasu's side, and she can hear people screaming below decks, but thus far the ship is still moving. It's the ship that Alabaster dropped rocks on. Some of the boulders are gone from its aft deck, and it's sitting normally in the water again. She doesn't see the cannon, but she does see three figures standing near the ship's bow. Two in burgundy, a third in black. As she watches, another burgundy-clad figure comes to join them. She can feel their eyes on her. The Guardian ship turns slightly, falling farther behind. Sinai begins to hope, but she sees it when the cannons fire this time. Three of them.
big black things near the starboard railing. They jerk and roll back a little when they fire in near unison.